Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor, a podcast from Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Group. Thank you for being with us. You know, at the Monitor, we focus on developments in the world of environmental and natural resources law and policy. And as we pay attention to developments in those areas or take a look at what 2022 might hold in terms of legislation or big policy changes like we did in our last episode, we also want to have conversations about how attorneys and companies can make sense of and act on all of the information, all of the developments swirling about in the trade press or in articles or in press releases, all what our partner Anne Navarro likes to call the churn, as she put it in our latest podcast. And as much as I know you enjoy spending your commute with me and wish this podcast could be all me, one of the things we're also excited to do is to introduce you to our partners and colleagues throughout the firm. And so today I'm excited to introduce you to a couple of our new friends, Will Marsh and Travis Counts. They're two of our colleagues here at the firm in our Houston office with really significant in-house experience. And what we're going to be talking about today and what we're excited to learn from them is just how general counsels and in-house counsels think about developments in the world of ESG. Now, I imagine that you, just like I do, have an inbox loaded with emails and invitations and all things related to ESG. There's a lot of discussion about ESG and the world out there, but don't turn that dial. Don't switch to your next podcast because I'm really excited about this conversation because I think figuring out how businesses and in-house counsel and general counsels make sense of this world of ESG is actually a really relevant and engaging conversation. And so I'm excited to welcome you, Will, and welcome you, Travis. Before we jump into that topic, I would love just to hear a little bit about your experience, what your background is. You know, y'all are relatively new to the firm. So Travis, why don't we start with you? Tell us your story.
Sure. So in a nutshell, I have been an upstream oil and gas and securities lawyer for the entirety of my career. I joined Bracewell in September of 2021. And prior to that, I was an in-house lawyer, ultimately general counsel of a company called Concho Resources that sold to ConocoPhillips in about this time at the beginning of 2021. So I've been at the firm for 4 months and in-house lawyer and at another firm before that. So in a nutshell, that's me.
Thanks, Travis. What about you, Will?
Well, first, thanks for having us on the podcast today. It's a pleasure to be on with you guys and enjoy talking about one of our favorite subjects, ESG. I started as an M&A lawyer, worked for a private law firm for 8 or 9 years. Was a partner with a firm out of Philadelphia and joined Baker Hughes back in 98. And I spent about just over 20 years with Baker Hughes, doing all kinds of different things for Baker Hughes. The last 7 or 8 years, I was general counsel and chief legal officer. And we ended up selling control of the company to GE. And so I helped a little bit with the integration of that sale. And then after that, left the company and am excited to be here at Bracewell. I worked with a lot of Bracewell attorneys while I was at Baker Hughes, really learned to appreciate Bracewell as a firm and the people here. And so I'm excited to be here and trying to add whatever value I can to the firm. So it's a great firm. I'm happy to be here.
Well, welcome to you both. And we are also joined by the inimitable Tim Wilkins as well. Didn't mention him at the beginning, but so great to have Tim, who is still, you know, adding to his lead in terms of podcast appearances. I'm going to try to avoid getting into a protracted...
Tim's who we all think of when we talk about ESG anyway.
That's so right. That's right.
Just expect to have Tim on with us.
Absolutely. But I also, when I think about Tim, I also think about his undying, passionate love for the Kansas City Chiefs. And we could easily get off track here and talk about whether a coin should be able to decide divisional playoffs. Tim, do you have 30 seconds of a hot take on that? Because I know you're glad at the result. The rules are the rules.
My hot take on that is that the coin toss was only part of the equation, but there was one Patrick Mahomes that threw about 6 passes to get that last touchdown. But yes, we were very pleased at the result.
Are you going to be going to any of those games?
I will not.
If we could be as efficient as the Kansas City Chiefs, we should be able to do this podcast in 13 seconds.
That would be incredible.
Indeed.
With the same result.
That's right. Championship level podcasting. I do think that we do have a good chance of winning whatever sort of environmental and natural resources podcast Super Bowl there is out there. Competition is minimal. But to kind of circle back to ESG, which has been, you know, I'm excited to talk with you all about it because you have seen that and grow out of corporate social responsibility and some of the other predecessor concepts. Since I've been at the firm, since I've been an attorney over the past 3 or 4 years, it's always been ESG. So I would love it if the three of y'all could sort of set the table for our listeners who have been potentially living under a rock and have not really encountered a decent description of what ESG is. So, you know, what's sort of ESG 101?
Yeah, I can sort of start with that. And it's interesting. It's a really simplistic way to refer to three very distinct concepts that are vastly more complicated than just the description of, you know, an easy reference with the letters ESG. So E stands for environmental, S stands for social, G stands for governance. And so those issues, those are sort of the descriptions of those issues. And within each of those issues, there's, from a corporate perspective anyway, numerous different subtopics that relate to that. And then, you know, disclosure issues, compliance issues, risk issues, business management issues, all of those things, those three topics, you know, affect all of those things, and companies just have to figure out how to handle them.
Yeah, I think if you look at the evolution of ESG, I go back to in 2010, we at Baker Hughes, we rolled out an enterprise risk management plan, which we thought enterprise risk management, that's the new thing, that's going to be the big topic. I think enterprise risk management didn't ever really rise up to the level of importance people thought it would have. But I think in a lot of ways, it set the precedent for what ESG would be and how it would work. And you look at ESG and you say, well, traditionally you've had health, safety, environmental groups within a company who would do their health, safety, environmental reports. You might have something on the legal side where you would do governance, some governance reports. I think, at least on the oilfield services side, in the early 2010 timeframe, we were very focused on compliance and we were issuing a lot of things publicly about compliance. And I think ESG, obviously, there's been a bigger focus on some of the social side of things that I think were missing previously. And we're seeing some of those get picked up. But it's really bringing all of those together in my mind. And it does raise a lot of interesting issues. I'm sure we're going to get an opportunity to discuss today about who covers what, how do you bring these different groups that were handling different parts of what's now ESG, how do you bring them all together and how do you make that an effective process? And from a legal standpoint, how do you protect yourself in that process? You know, what are some of those risks and things that you face there?
And again, you know, thinking back specifically as this relates to enterprise risk a decade or so ago or more, you could have gone through, I think several companies may have gone through their enterprise risk processes to the extent they even had them back in the day. And maybe one of their, and it seems odd to refer to ESG as a risk, but let's say as a discussion topic anyway, query how many of those companies conducting those risk assessments even flagged that as a top issue before. Whereas now, query how you could not identify it as a top issue.
Yeah, and I think you and I talked about this the other day, Travis, how it's a top issue now. Whether it is for the company or not, it is for your investors and your stakeholders. So it's got to be a top issue now.
No, that's really an excellent point, Will. I mean, the external drivers here, whether a company is focused on ESG factors internally versus financial factors or other factors, that's one thing. But the external drivers, whether that's the investing public, whether that's legislators, regulators, whether that's the financial community, those are folks who are focused on these issues, and they expect an understanding that a company is prioritizing those issues, and they want some transparency into the companies about those issues and how they're being handled.
And also just to sort of dive even further into this, and it highlights the complexity of these issues. You refer to the investing public, right? There are so many influential voices, even within that subset of stakeholder, that it can be really challenging to you can't make everybody, I mean, from an in-house lawyer's perspective, it's really hard to make everybody happy, but a lot of people through various means have a way to have their voice be heard. And so how, you know, receiving all those inputs, validating them, figuring out what you're going to do with them, reporting to senior management, reporting to the board, getting a strategy, implementing that strategy, responding, showing that you are, all of these things, it's ESG. I mean, come on, it's ESG. So simple to say ESG. But in practice, it's far, far, far more complicated.
Well, yeah, to your point, Travis, I think each one of our guests has used the phrase, these issues. And from the cheap seats, it seems like ESG, it's almost like that Walt Whitman phrase, like I contain multitudes. Right? A lot of different kinds of environmental, social, or governance related concerns kind of slip in the tent pretty easily. And I think that kind of goes to one of the problems that a general counsel might face in advising their company, right? Like making sense of what we actually count as ESG and how we define that term. It's difficult to do because it's an ever evolving concept. These buckets are huge. For the sort of the uninitiated. So we've kind of talked about how ESG contains a number of issues that impact a client's access to capital and all other kinds of things like that. Can you give us sort of like some basics on how a company shows and demonstrates its commitment to ESG related goals? There's not an ESG act, right? At least right now. There is not a series of regulations stating in precise terms that thou shalt observe and demonstrate your commitment to ESG, right? At least not yet. So how are the basic way, like how do companies basically demonstrate that they're concerned about ESG?
Well, it's interesting. There's not any specific SEC guidelines yet. Well, there's some SEC guidelines from back in 2010 that people are following. You see the SEC getting into more depth in that through comment letters and some other things. But you're right. At the end of the day, there's no SEC regulations that say ESG and here's what you have to have. You do see some of these other things out there like the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. That seems to be the guidelines they set up, seem to be something that people are wanting to follow. And the SEC has given some indications they may be going that direction. Some of the...
That's the TCFD. That's when TCFD. You hear, I mean, that's the TCFD.
And what you're talking about are basically disclosures or reports that a company would publish.
Principles. Like disclosure principles, okay. Basically.
And then you would craft a report in light of those principles containing the contents that those principles specify. And then you distribute that to shareholders and the general public.
Basically, lots of times you'll see those reports will reference specific sections of the TCFD. There's other ones out there. There's the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, the SASB. So you see those out there. All of those are kind of floating out there. UN's got some guidelines. And so, yeah, you'll see a report published that will reference some of those guidelines and frameworks, and companies publish them different ways.
And even that, so it's kind of circling back to what we're talking about. Will mentioned SEC activity. There has been a tremendous amount and focus really within the last year, but specifically in the last 6 months or so around, it gets to the broader sort of question that always intrigues and concerns lawyers is consistency, right? What are you saying? Where are you saying it? Who's requiring you to say it? Who's relying on it? So you've got all these frameworks. None of them are mandated right now. companies are all over the board as to whether they disclose anything that most of them do these days, but how they disclose it. I mean, I've seen companies generate a 100-page sustainability report. And I've signed shareholder calls where they say, give us a 2-page, you know, list of metrics. We don't want to see your 100-page report. And so, you know, again, this is all changing literally real time in front of our eyes.
Absolutely. This is the definition of a moving target is yes. ESG. It's all over the board right now. I think the SEC is trying to get more control over it, but it's a tough, I mean, as we talked this morning, it's so encompassing. It's a tough one to really get your arms around and say, here's what it should look like.
And, you know, thoughts that come to my mind, as we talked about earlier, of these three different ESG representing these three different areas. I think about things like shareholder proposals, for example, right? These are typically not voluntary things that a company has to disclose. But their disclosures, you know, responses to them are disclosures nonetheless. And this is a way that a stakeholder, sometimes not even, if you all are familiar, well, I'm not going to presume today, the thresholds for including a shareholder's proposal in a public company's proxy are not, at least in my opinion, very stringent. And so that affords the ability for someone who owns a relatively small piece of a company to have a very substantial impact on the message of the company and maybe ultimately on the business strategy of the company. And so you're seeing that's a whole, you know, you ask, where do these things show up? They show up on websites. They show up on sustainability reports. They show up in SEC filings like that a company does. Well, this issue may present itself because one of your shareholders is forcing you to discuss it.
I'm very glad that I took business associations and corporations in law school because it's giving me some ability to track that.
Just to follow up on Travis's point, it may be a shareholder who just bought a few shares solely with the idea of making that shareholder proposal. So could
absolutely.
Be anybody.
It could be,
and they do that to 100 other
exactly,
companies, yeah, the yeah. exact same proposal, and they have, you know.
So at least you don't feel lonely.
It's a cottage industry for some.
In addition to understanding our conversation about, you know, shareholder activism and that sort of thing, the other reason I'm glad that I took business associations and a few other courses in law school is that it really made me understand some of the subtleties of Die Hard when I watch it annually. But that's neither here nor there. Going back to, Will, your comment about this being a fast moving target, like the definition of a fast moving target. You know, what are some of the, and these reports and these disclosures where you're talking about things that your company does, there's shareholder scrutiny of the contents of those documents and publications and disclosures. You know, what are some of the main high level concerns that a general counsel might have with the increasing pressure to publish these kinds of reports or to engage with ratings agencies or make other kind, you know, one thing we haven't talked about are public commitments that we're seeing from a lot of companies now about, you know, carbon reductions or maybe a commitment to sort of like net zero carbon. So what are those big concerns?
I think this is where the general counsel gets you really put behind the eight ball because you've got a lot of different factions involved in the ESG reporting. Marketing wants a hand in it. Your health, safety, environmental group wants a hand in it. Your communications and investor relations groups want a hand in it. And obviously legal's got to have some control over it. The board, each board member hears different things about ESG and they want certain things in the ESG or sustainability reporting, whatever you call it. And so you have a lot of different people that have their hands in that ESG reporting and what goes out to the public, whether it's a report, whether it's public commitments. And so you as general counsel, you know, the first thing you got to do is make sure that what you're saying in your ESG reporting matches up with your periodic reports. You don't want to say two different things because that's an easy in for the share for plaintiff's lawyers to come in and start pointing out differences. And you also have to be careful you don't start setting a lower materiality standard in your sustainability reporting. I found lots of times you got people who want to highlight something that the company did, but it's not that material. And so if you highlight that, you've kind of set a precedence on materiality going forward. And, you know, that can become a problem, especially as the SEC is what we've seen in some of these comment letters, is the SEC is asking companies to reconcile between things that they have in their ESG reporting and things that they have in their periodic reports. And so I think you'll see the SEC, in my opinion, we're going to see the SEC start looking at those sustainability reports, and they're going to look at that for the precedent you set on materiality. So I think as a general counsel, that's really a concern that I would have, is to say, to make sure that we've got consistency between those reports. Because you could, and you really need to go through the same process with those reports you go through with a 10K or an 10Q. Have your disclosure committees review them. Have internal audit review numbers. And all of those internal processes and procedures and internal controls that we have, disclosure controls, need to be applied to the sustainability report.
And also have your board, I would recommend, review it and buy into it, right? Especially as the disclosures continue to evolve into more commitments. Imagine the scenario, again, it's sort of a in-house lawyer's nightmare, but imagine the scenario where you're getting an SEC, you know, enforcement action against you for disclosures in a document that's widely disseminated to your shareholders that your board may or may not have ever even seen.
Right? That wouldn't be pleasant.
That would be unfortunate.
It wouldn't be a pleasant conversation.
But that's, you know, but I mean, again, Will and I, you kind of think about the corporate calendar. People refer to the corporate calendar, and the corporate calendar is dictated by periodic reporting for the most part, board meetings associated with that. And then you've got your proxy that we're in proxy season right now. So here's another deliverable potentially that is critically important, and building that into your corporate calendar and getting the socialization internally, you know, with management and with the board, and having enough time to generate a concise product that conforms with all of your other disclosures that you've got, that is responsive to the various stakeholder inputs that you're receiving. You can kind of just start to visualize a massive process to generate the types of outputs that we're talking about today, you know, reporting on these things, and just how complicated it is and how much time it can take, not just for the general counsel office, but for an entire organization. It's, and, you know, even down to the contents of the report, how do you go about defining things? What's a barrel of water? You know, a gallon of water, however you want to, like, how do you measure? How do you define? And then how do you wrap all that up in a way to be able to disclose it and have it be usable and useful?
Yeah, I would add, in addition to the sort of consistency and the accuracy and, you know, making sure you're talking about the relevant factors, there really needs to be an emphasis on ensuring that any claims that are made in this voluntary reporting are really supportable. Will touched on that with respect to, you know, making sure that all of the stakeholders inside the company are included and have a chance to vet any claims. But if you're making a claim about, you know, your environmental performance, you better have data to back it up, validated data, because it's going to be subject to scrutiny, not just internally, but externally in the future. And, you know, I have, especially in the earlier days of sustainability reporting, I've certainly seen a very marketing driven, look how much we recycle and support the Little League and whatever, right? I mean, all of the kinds of fuzzy claims about good corporate citizenship or good neighborhood something. It is really, I think, critical as ESG becomes a driver for investment, becomes a focus of the regulators, that you have really robust systems and really robust validation of the stuff underlying any claims that you make.
And you see more, I mentioned earlier, but you see more and more stakeholders don't want a 7,500 page sustainability report. They don't want to know some of the stuff that you think makes your company look good. They just want data.
It gets tempting because you've got, like I say, you get the comms, the marketing side, the investor relations, and they love to put out those big glossy reports. So,
to, you know, what's jumping out to me right now is that if you're looking at various ESG related disclosures or reporting, and you're looking at that fast moving target, and more and more targets sort of entering under the tent or under the banner of ESG, things that you want to address. If you don't have that culture or that conversation at the top, that kind of fast moving target or that fast moving train can sort of pull everything else out of alignment across all of the different reports that you're generating to just comply with, you know, basic SEC disclosure requirements. And then you end up in a situation where you do sort of a $200,000 good environmental thing, and you go plant some trees and you highlight that, but then you're not disclosing material penalties, you know, used against that same sort of benchmark. And then you just have that massive inconsistency. So that's pretty interesting to think about.
No, I was just, the other piece of this is, again, I just keep circling back to the importance of the buy-in. Well, I mean, the board's purpose is to set the strategy of the corporation, right? And so, Daniel, to your point earlier, if you're just sort of flailing around without that buy-in, it's difficult to produce a quality product. If someone wants to get attention at the highest levels, ultimately, we are starting to see consequences for boards for failure to act on certain ESG issues. And so there was a campaign last year, a very, very prominent one, and with a very large international company. The result of it was that the shareholder public was dissatisfied with this company's board's strategies related to climate change. And the consequence of that is three board members were replaced. And so, you know, in the end, you can hide under a rock for a little while, but ultimately one of the primary consequences of doing that is that directors are going to get voted out.
And I have, Daniel,
one way to get attention.
As Daniel was talking, Travis, I had the same thought. You know, if the best way to not let this thing get out ahead of you is to make sure you've got the board involved in pretty much every step of the process. So that's a good point.
Add that to the list.
Yeah.
You know, it's a busy board schedule every quarter.
And it's getting busier.
Moving away from the disclosure conversation that we've had, I'd be curious to hear what you think the general counsel's role is if a company adopts a particular ESG target or goal. How does the GC help achieve those goals or maximize the value to the business side? Because one of the things I've done a little bit of reading on ESG and the general counsel position, and there are a number of companies and a number of GCs that would prefer to just sort of stick to the business, right? Like stick to the real profit centers and drivers and make sure that those are well protected. And then a number of GCs are engaging with ESG. So, you know, there's a tension there between something that's sort of nebulous and at the same time fast moving like ESG, and that, you know, the more easily quantified business metrics of the firm. So how does the GC help achieve some of these goals that we're seeing companies set for themselves on ESG basis?
Well, I think one thing even before that is the GC has to be involved in setting those goals and setting that strategy, because you don't want to get a goal that you say, hold it, how are we ever going to support that we can meet this goal, or how are we ever going to reach this goal? So I think my initial response would be, you've got to start before that. You've got to be part of the discussion when goals are being set, strategic goals and sustainability goals. And that's where you get your buy-in. And then from that buy-in, it makes it much easier to go and assist and help in those goals being met.
And then I would completely agree. And then you sort of add to that, ensuring that there's accountability. GCs are typically pretty good at that and usually responsible for it. And so, you know, once that sustainability report goes out the door, you know, gathering inputs, making sure that inputs are received from the stakeholders, like large institutional shareholders, for example, just making sure that there's communication and accountability, and then sort of related to both of those things, just follow up and follow through. And so, you know, in making sure that the conversation's ongoing with the board and that there's that accountability piece of, say, we said we were going to do these five things. Where are we at on that? That may be the role of the general counsel. It, you know, ideally it probably wouldn't be, but if it's not someone else's role, then it probably should be the GC's role, right? Which is how a lot of my experience is. That's how a lot of issues present themselves to the GC's office, right?
The last one standing is the musical chairs.
And I also think the other place where the legal department overall can really help is if you have a strong compliance group. Compliance groups are there to be sure policies are enforced or procedures are followed. So you should have some expertise in that area in your compliance group. And so I would use your compliance group as part of, I don't know if enforcement's the right word, but part of the process for making sure that you're documenting the goals, you're documenting the processes and procedures, because that's really part of what your compliance group does anyway.
We talked about this previously, but that's an important piece. What Will just described is, as it relates to enterprise risk, as it relates to ESG, as it relates to documenting that at least that there's a conversation going on. And then if you're tracking certain metrics or whatever, just making sure that there's some record that that you're at least trying to comply and do what you say you've done. Critically important, because someone's going to be asking.
I think that's a great place to leave the conversation for now.
No, we can't be done already, Dan, are we? We're just getting going.
I know. I think that means that we'll have to have both of you back, assuming that we haven't scared you off.
Good job, Will.
This is, I think that this is such a huge topic, a rapidly evolving topic. This podcast episode, if we revisit it in a year, I think we'll be able to, point out some pretty significant changes, some new insights that we have. And so maybe January 25th, 2023, we'll get back together, and spend some time, talking about the year that was. But, it's so great to have both of you here to help us get wise on, what the concerns are in that chair, right? In the general counsel's office. And that's certainly educational for me. And I know that it's helpful to our listeners. So thank you, Travis, for being with us. Thank you, Will. And thank you, Tim. And thank you, dear listener, for spending a little bit of time with us. And we will talk to you soon.